This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you want to talk about alcohol and obvious cliches, wine is the drink for connoisseurs, beer is the populist beverage. But my guest Michael Jackson writes as seriously about beer as wine experts do about the grape. He is considered by many to be the world's leading consumer writer on beer, and I suppose he doesn't have all that much competition. His books include The New World Guide to Beer and The Pocket Guide to Beer. He's also written a couple of books about single malt scotch. And he did a TV series called The Beer Hunter for London's Channel 4 and the U.S. Discovery Channel. Beer drinkers in America are becoming more discriminating. Imports are increasingly popular, as are American regional beers from the new microbreweries. And this makes Michael Jackson very happy.
I'm an unapologetic beer snob. I'm not a snob in other aspects of life. Perhaps I'm almost an inverted snob, you know, that I tend to go for the things that are perhaps not given the respect that they should be. And that's perhaps one of the things that attracted me to beer in the first place. There is an extraordinary diversity of beer available in the United States now. In fact, in some American cities, there's a bigger diversity of beer available than there is in any European city. I'm thinking particularly of Seattle, which is becoming very famous for its beer, but you could say that of Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco, too.
Why do you think this upscaling of beer is happening?
Well, the actual movement, I mean, there is a renaissance of serious interest in beer, and that can quite clearly be defined as having started in Britain in 1971. A group of people who fortunately happened to be journalists were complaining to each other on vacation about how beer was becoming more and more bland and more standardized, and they said, you know, we really should start a campaign for real ale, because ale is the type of beer that's principally drunk in Britain. They started that campaign, and it really took off, quite astonished them. They thought this was something fairly lighthearted, and it became a major national campaign. And one of the consequences of that was that a number of people began to start small breweries, and this was really the first time since perhaps before the First World War that anybody in any Western country had really been starting breweries. Breweries had been things that closed, and suddenly there were things that opened. I think if you look at it more broadly, you can see this in any kind of consumer product. You can see it in bread, cheese, coffee, pastas, that in a way perhaps mass marketing has reached its peak, and at its peak has made people perhaps yearn for more diversity, more traditional products, I think.
I think I'm typical of a lot of Americans in the sense that I drink my share of beer, but I know very little about how it's made. And it's really easy for me to visualize the making of wine, even though I know very little about that, too, because, you make the grapes into a liquid and they ferment. But I don't understand how beer is made out of malt. I mean, I've really never understood that. I don't mean malt. I mean barley.
Well, let's see what we do mean.
What do we mean?
The two are very, very... wine and beer are made by very, very similar processes. They are.
But you don't step on barley.
Well, you can if you want to. It doesn't do you an awful lot of good. I mean, really, wine is a less sophisticated product because you can just step on the grapes and get the juice out of them, and the juice will ferment. As a result of the wild yeast that was on the skins, and then you have your wine, and your winemaker then tells you, if you don't like it, well, tough, it wasn't a very good year, you know, which brewers never tell you. What beer is made out of grain. I mean, wine is made out of fruit, and the fruit is usually the grape. Yeah. It doesn't have to be. Beer is made out of grain, and the grain is usually barley, but it doesn't have to be. Other grains are used to some extent, especially wheat. In order to get the natural fermentable sugars out of the grape, all you have to do is crush it. In order to get the natural fermentable sugars out of the grain, you have to soak it in water so that it begins to sprout, and then let it sprout for about a week. And at that point, that the sprouting of it is at the optimum, and you want to then stabilize it. So you stabilize it by heat. And that process, the process of taking grains, sprouting them, and arresting the sprouting by drying, is the process of malting. So when you've done that to barley, you've got barley malt. When you've done it to wheat, you've got wheat malt. We just usually just call it malt. Malt is the real, what grapes are to wine, barley malt or wheat malt is to beer.
In preparing for the interview with you, I found all these beer commercials and their lyrics going through my head, like brewed with pride and just a kiss of the hops, you know. It's like, you listen to all this as a kid and wonder, what is it?
A kiss of the hops is quite a nice way of putting it, really. I suspect I probably said that in something I've written, because they are there. The hops are there as a seasoning, and it's very much like if you were if you were making, say, espresso coffee, cappuccino, and you put a little bit of chocolate on top of the foam, just a little kiss of chocolate, it's just there as a last little finishing seasoning to balance the flavors out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Jackson, who is considered by many to be the world's leading expert and writer about beer. And his books include The Pocket Guide to Beer, The New World Guide to Beer. Now he's also an expert on scotch, and he's the author of Michael Jackson's Complete Guide to Single Malt Scotch. Have you drunk a lot of light beer?
No, I haven't, and I don't really see any reason for drinking light beer. No beer will make anybody thin. You cannot lose weight by drinking beer. Some people, and I have this problem myself, are very susceptible to putting on weight by drinking beer. Other people, it depends on your metabolism, other people seem to be able to drink quite a lot of beer without putting on weight. The lady I attempt to share my life with is very, very slim indeed, and used to work in the fashion industry, and she likes to drink Guinness by the pint. And if I do that, you know, just from looking at the Guinness, I've already put a pound on, and she doesn't seem to. But nobody ever lost weight by drinking beer. So if you're worried about your weight, the best thing to do is drink less beer and maybe drink better beer.
Well, why not drink light beer? It does seem to, as advertised, have fewer calories.
Well, light beer is really scarcely worthy of the name beer. I mean, it's beer with water added. Why not just get regular beer and add water if you want to do that? But then why on earth would you want to do that? And whenever I see people drinking light beer, they're usually filling their face with nacho chips anyway. You know, there are more calories in a nacho chip than there are in a glass of beer. Also, the difference in calories between light beers and regular beers is really not very great. You know, you're talking about sort of something in the 90s in terms of calories with a light beer and something in the lower hundreds with a regular beer. It's not worth doing that. All you're going to do is drink more of the beer. The beer's not very good. Why not just drink less beer and drink good beer?
Or drink wine? I mean, does wine have a lot fewer calories than beer does?
Wine does have fewer calories than beer, and I like wine very much as well. I mean, all of my books are about beer and whiskey and single malt scotches. The Manchester Guardian came out with a very nice line when they said, other writers on drink write about the grape. Michael Jackson's the guru of the grain, and I thought that was a very nice way of putting it. So those are my passions. My passions are beer and single malt scotches, but I still enjoy wine, and I don't see wine as the enemy. I'm looking for equal time for beer, I think.
You've traveled around the world tasting beers, but you live in England, so you're very familiar with the pubs there, and I imagine you've been to the United States a lot and are very familiar with the bars here. What interests you most in the difference between English pubs and American bars?
Well, you know, I spend so much time in the United States that I sometimes half forget what an English pub is like. But when I go home, it's probably the first port of call I make is to go to my local. English pubs are places where you meet to talk to people. And that's why there's a lot of standing up in them, because you can wander across to people. You're not locked into a table you're sitting at. If you are sitting at a table, it'll probably be very small little stools that you can sort of move one up to the next table if you want to join the crowd at the next table. English pubs are really about social contact. Bars in America are very often very, very gloomy places. The long shadow of Prohibition is still hanging over many American bars. And the places that are not so gloomy tend really to be restaurants that have a bar in that serves drinks. There isn't really anything like the pub in the United States. I suppose the nearest thing is the big old tavern that you find in some of the more Germanic cities of the United States, but mainly in the East and the Midwest. Places like the Berghoff in Chicago, and there are a couple of those in Milwaukee. Max Hall is in New York, but even that is not really quite such a sociable place as an English pub would be.
Do you ever go to an American bar, one of the solitary bars where everybody's sitting, not talking to each other, on a bar stool and have a drink?
The sort of set 'em up Joe.
Yes, exactly.
Suicidal bars. not if I can help it. I mean, they always seem to be people there always look as if they're about to commit suicide or about to enter into a sort of Richard Ford short story or something like that. I mean, in fact, on the other occasions when I do go there, the guy next to me will usually start telling me his life story and how he's just been laid off or something and his wife left him. And you know, I think maybe I should be writing Richard Ford short stories instead of writing about the beer. But the beer in those places is never worth writing about.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Jackson, who writes about beer, is the author of The Pocket Guide to Beer, The New World Guide to Beer. He's considered perhaps the world's leading expert on beer. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Michael Jackson is my guest, and we're talking about what is probably his favorite subject, which is beer. Let's talk about single malt scotches, which is another big subject of yours. What's the difference between a blended whiskey, a blended scotch,
right,
and a single malt scotch?
Well, if you buy any of the well-known blended whiskies, I mean, Dewar's, J&B, Ballantine's, all of the well-known ones, Johnny Walker, are all blends. What you get in that bottle is really an astonishingly large number of malt whiskies, maybe 45 different whiskies in a typical bottle of, say, Ballantine's or Johnny Walker. And those 45 different malt whiskies are blended together to try to give a roundness, a flavour that'll keep everybody happy. And they occupy about 40% of the liquid in the bottle. The other 60% of the liquid in the bottle is a lighter-tasting grain whiskey, which may be made from barley malt or unmalted barley or wheat or any grain that they choose, and is really a sort of filler. It's still quite tasty, but it is a sort of filler. Now, some of those products are, well, all of those products are all very fine products. But supposing you're drinking your glass of Chivas and you're thinking, well, there's something in here from the Highlands and there's something from the Lowlands and there's something from the Islands. I wonder what those whiskies would taste like on their own. Well, the way to find that out is to sample some of the single malts. It's the difference between listening to an orchestra and listening to a soloist. The single malt's a soloist.
I don't know how much you're into the folklore surrounding different drinks, but I'm thinking if you think you got a chill today or you're coming down with a cold or something, you're not going to go pour yourself a glass of wine or even have a beer. You'll pour yourself a shot of scotch.
I did once read a remedy. It was written by a Frenchman, of course, that if you had wine, about a pint of Burgundy a day would be very good for you. If you had a cold, a pint of Burgundy a day would be very good for you. I don't take that terribly seriously.
Right.
But, Scotch certainly gives the appearance of being much more warming, and since it's relatively strong, probably quite antiseptic too. I'm sticking to that belief anyway.
Some people say that you won't get as hungover with Scotch as you will with beer or wine. What's your experience?
My experience, I regret to say, is to the contrary. I have a very definite belief about hangovers, which is essentially that the blander the product is, the less likely you are to get a hangover from it, and the fuller in flavor it is, not fuller in body, but fuller in flavor it is, probably more complex in flavor, probably the greater your chance of getting a hangover. That's all of my experience, and I believe it to be true, and I believe it to be based on the fact that the natural chemical compounds that occur in fine wines, fine beers, single malt scotches that make them complex and interesting, unfortunately, may also give you a hangover if you drink too much of them.
Hmm.
There was some British writer who said he felt sorry for people who didn't wake up with a hangover because that was as good as they were going to feel all day. I just throw that little philosophical thought into our discussion.
Do you get hungover much, or are you such the professional at drinking that you never overdrink?
Well, I very rarely drink too much. That maybe makes me sound like a bit of a party pooper, but when I'm working, I'm drinking to taste these products, so I'm certainly not chugging them. I think we all occasionally go to a dinner party, perhaps, and you know, have rather a lot of wine and maybe have a digestive afterwards and get a hangover. And I do suffer rather, when I do get a hangover, I suffer miserably from hangovers. And there's no real cure. I mean, you can drink a lot of water before you go to bed, but you probably don't remember to do that. The most important thing to do if you have a hangover, really, is to do something about your blood sugar level in the morning. And the best thing to do is to, you really have to eat something, however little you feel like eating something. You really must eat something. You must force yourself to eat something. Something like toast and honey is very good. Or I think my sort of classic Jewish recipe, although it's a Jewish recipe for everything, of course, is chicken soup. But chicken soup is very good for getting rid of a hangover.
Even for breakfast, huh?
Well, depends how late you lay in, I suppose.
How did you get involved with being a professional beer writer, especially given that so few people have focused on beer as compared to wine.
I was originally a newspaper journalist, and I still contribute a lot to newspapers, and I contribute to the food pages of a London paper called The Independent, and occasionally to The Washington Post and to various food and drink magazines. But originally I was a hard news journalist and then a columnist, and for a time a television journalist too. And all my buddies, they all drank beer. Journalists all drank beer. They all loved it. They all talked about it incessantly among themselves. Do you think this one's better than one we had last night? You know, I was on an assignment in such a city and I had this one, and wow, you should taste that. They were fascinated with beer, yet when it came to the idea of trying to persuade the newspaper or the magazine or the TV station to actually do something about beer, they would say, oh, well, people aren't interested in that.
You mean to cover it?
Yes, even though they were all interested in it themselves, they somehow thought that their readers out there had a quite different perception. And I always felt that it was very odd that people loved drinking beer and then went off to write articles about wine. So I was always trying to... I was a sort of guerrilla warrior, even in those days, trying to get stories about beer into the paper. Very often, the only way around doing that was to actually ostensibly write about pubs and sort of sneak in the beer information. The pub was the Trojan horse, and you snuck in the beer information inside that Trojan horse. And eventually, somebody asked me to write a book on pubs, and really halfway through writing the book, I mean, I accepted the assignment and the book eventually was published and everybody was happy with it. But halfway through, I'd realized I really wanted to write a book about beer.
Mm-hmm. When did you first start developing a taste for things like beer and scotch?
My parents didn't drink, so they weren't anti-drink, but they just didn't drink very much. And so it was a sort of almost bravado when I was a young journalist to go out and drink beer. I mean, I liked beer right from the age of 16, when I was actually too young really to go in a pub. I liked beer very much, and I was always really fascinated by it. I tasted my first single malt scotch at the age of about 18, at a time when single malt scotches were scarcely available outside Scotland. And in fact, I did taste it in Scotland, and I just thought it was wonderful. And I'd been wanting to write about single malt scotches ever since, but it was hard ever to persuade a publisher to publish anything on that, because they said, look, nobody's heard of them, you know, you can't get them. But now that's really changing.
Let me ask you one final question. Are you tired of people making Michael Jackson jokes, you know, about the singer versus you?
Well, I guess if I'm not used to it now, I never will be.
What's your standard comeback on that?
Well, it depends precisely what the joke is. But, you know, I like to point out to people that I had the name first. I've considered writing to the other Michael Jackson, saying that for a very small royalty, I'll license my name to him. Otherwise, I'll sue him for stealing my name. I'm a terrible dancer, but I can sing. I think when I sing rather more black people's music than he does, because I'm a lover of the blues. So... I even have a glove, right, which I occasionally use just for a little joke.
Oh, really?
Tasting glove, you know, to put a bit of glitter into my beer.
Well, Michael Jackson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Jackson is the author of The New World Guide to Beer, The Pocket Guide to Beer, and The Complete Guide to Single Malt Scotch.